we have last week now already entered into this last week of Jesus' life. And so we spoke of that triumphal entry last week. And, you know, I just tore the internet apart trying to find some sort of decent representation of the triumphal entry. And I couldn't find one, just mostly from the standpoint that the Gospels, if you remember from last week, are very clear that there were two animals involved. And the second one is just always, you know, ignored. So Jesus was prophesied by Zechariah that he would be riding in on the colt, the foal of an ass, depending on the translation that you have, a donkey. But apparently, while he is riding the younger animal, the older, the mother, would have been also there, probably led by a halter, you know, in front of Jesus, so that the colt would follow mom. And always, you only see one. The scriptures tell us that there were two. And so let's get the picture right, you know, just to begin with. And then to recognize, I didn't take any time on it last week, but if you look back, for instance, at the coronation of King Solomon, I have very great reservations about this just solely or exclusively being portrayed by God from the standpoint of humility. You'll always hear all the commentators and everybody, you know, focuses on, you know, the humility of riding on a donkey instead of the great white charger and all of that. But from the time of Solomon, that was how they brought their kings in for coronation. And so it was not, you know, only what we might think of as a humble thing because he is not a great warrior horse, but it also was the way they brought their kings in to accept the crown and to become the sole monarch. So there is some element, at least, of glory and the anticipation that should also be understood. And that's why you have the crowds just going crazy and throwing the palm fronds down and waving them as well as their cloaks, you know, as Jesus is coming into Jerusalem, coming down westbound the Mount of Olives. And as he's coming down that slope, he is approaching then what is the eastern wall of Jerusalem. Remember the original Herodian stones, 46 years it took to build not just the temple, but the Temple Mount and all the rest that went with it. So we know exactly the perimeter. Those walls that you see, you know, there, we know were the ones that Herod at least laid the foundation stones for. And Jesus very likely would have been coming down this very slope. And as he's coming down that slope, you know, the city's boiling out to meet him. The huge crowds of extremely exuberant and overjoyed people that are receiving their king. This is the way on that same road that they do this, you know, to this day. Every year on Palm Sunday, huge numbers of people will go and try to recreate, you know, this event. And so this road and others that come down off the Mount of Olives in are just filled with these jubilant people looking just like that some year, you know, in the recent past. And then, as we go back to the preceding slide, you can see the golden dome of the mosque, but that is the exact location of where the temple was. And as tall and impressive as that is, the temple at the time was about 45 feet taller than that is. So very significantly larger in all directions from what that particular mosque looks like. And then as I go back to the succeeding picture again, you know, you can see it again in the distance there, but it gives you an idea of the scale. The Kidron Valley is not a big thing at all. It takes just a matter of a few minutes to walk on down the hill and up the other side. And when you go up the other side, there were, at that time, two gates that Jesus might have used to enter the city. This one, to this day, is called St. Stephen's Gate. It's also called the Lion's Gate. And every stone that you see there was built by a Muslim several centuries back, but it is in the immediate vicinity of where the original gate would have been. The gate itself doesn't exist back to Jesus' time, but, you know, in this particular area. It's called St. Stephen's Gate because it is believed it was right there in that immediate area where Stephen, in Acts chapter 7, was the first Christian to lose his life for the cause. And so as you go back up the other hill, then now here we have that same road as people are going up the other side of the Kidron Valley and approaching the city wall itself. And we also saw last week that first thing Jesus does then is he goes in for a second time to cleanse the temple. Now, if you've been doing the reading these last several weeks, you will notice that the editorial committee on this particular book has been making much out of the differences in the four Gospels, but particularly in the three called the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But they keep suggesting that time and time and time again, they're suggesting that either, you know, there's some sort of conflict between the record and there's only one event, but the writers speak of it very, very differently, and or, you know, there were different events that took place at different times. Now, this event, it's not hard to see at all, and it's beyond all doubt, Jesus did exactly the same thing on two different occasions. He cleansed the temple just like this at the very start of his preaching ministry. He did it again at the end. And that's not surprising to us. It's well attested in the Gospels. There's really no doubt about it. And so, you know, he did this physical thing, this very expressive and impressive and enlightening thing, you know, in pointing out how poorly these Jews had been keeping the old law and therefore offending God with all of their sin. So it's not hard, you know, we just say, well, he did it twice. I mean, shrug your shoulders, big deal, why not? But I noticed, you know, in the reading this week again and last week as well, that when they have different records of other events, you know, they make it sound as if we might have some sort of conflict or something going on here. And then particularly when we come to the eschatological material, and lo and behold, this is the big week, you know, for Matthew, Mark, and Luke, 23, 13, and 21 chapters respectively, dealing with what is called the Olivet Discourse, typically, you know, or that Sermon on Last Things that takes place on the Mount of Olives. And here, they did, I thought, you know, really a pretty poor job this last week of just either refusing or being unable to recognize that there's only one event, and there's only one topic, and that when you read the three gospel writers, John doesn't tell us about that sermon that we'll get to in a little bit, but, you know, John doesn't mention it, but the three that do, yes, they have some different material in each one. All that material took place on that one occasion, and all that material is talking about one topic. So I just want to point it out here at the beginning that kind of keep your eyes open for that. If, you know, this has been going on for some time, we only got two more weeks in the Gospels, but what you saw particularly this week, you know, is the bias, the beliefs of the various members of the editorial committee. In the material that we came to, which is a very large section of this last week's reading, that they're referring to as last things and suggesting that it's talking about both the fall of Jerusalem and then also the end of the world, you know, it's really just terribly mistaken. There's only one topic that's being discussed there. But tonight, we're not going to have a whole lot of time for it. Fortunately, we've been through it twice in recent history, and so I won't be able to spend much more time on it even perhaps than we have just now, but we'll do the best we can, and then just bear in mind that there is no such thing as a contradiction in Scriptures. It may be that we can't figure out how two seemingly, you know, differing things fit together, but they do, and in most cases, there's any number of commentaries and other additional helpful information that, you know, will show you how they can be resolved. Don't let these uninspired comments, you know, suggest that they really can't be to such an extent that they have to be talking about two totally different things. More on that in a minute, but we're in the last week, and so Jesus has but a few days left. In the entirety of his life, and the fulfillment of the entire Old Testament, everything written in 39 books of the Old Testament, is essentially all of it taking place, being discussed, you know, right here in this last week. So it is particularly, you know, a heavy reading that we're going through in these last 2 weeks, and will be for this week and the 2 weeks that are to come. So I know you're probably frustrated by it. I am too. Yeah, it's just impossible to answer all the questions because it really is the great climax of all the earth's history. everything since Adam and Eve, which I preached on last Sunday night, everything has to do, or excuse me, Sunday morning, but everything, you know, throughout all that time and all that discussion of Bible books comes to the crucifixion, the burial, the resurrection, and then the ascension of Jesus the Christ. So we're going to touch on only just the very highest, you know, high points outline of all of this. This I particularly liked as an artist's rendition of the cleansing of the temple there. You can see the chaos that Jesus must have established, but also, you know, it serves a little better than some of the others, to give us an idea of the grandeur of that temple. So I try every week to find other artists, illustrations. You read a section about Josephus who spends pages and pages telling us about it and giving us a tremendous amount of insight, which has been verified, of course, by modern archaeology. This would be the southern wall of the temple. This is the great ceremonial staircase that led up to two tunnels that were also gates that went up through the, you know, this massive 100 feet you had to rise inside and underground to eventually come up on the 37 acres of the Temple Mount. And then over here you can see just a little bit of that arch, the spring they call it, the first stones of that arch that are still in the wall today, built by Herod. Those were the stones that he had built. And then there was, you know, this bridge that came across and the staircase that came down from the magnificent to the wealthy part of town. You know, and it gives you a little bit here of a feel. 138 feet high it was from this point up to the top there. So it's just awesome structure that God had caused to be built since the days of Solomon to be his religious capital and the location of the Ark of the Covenant, of the sacrificial system, and all of that. Now, if you imagine the picture you just saw it in turning 180 degrees, this is where you would come out of those two tunnels onto the Temple Mount itself. This is the Soreg we talked about last week, actual stones from the first century that were mounted on this wall, telling the Gentiles that if they crossed over, they would die absolutely, and some did, penalty of death. This then was the general courtyard everybody could come into, and you can't see it here, I can't think so much time on again, but the courtyard of the women there, and then of the priests, you know, is in the temple structure itself. But it gives you some idea of how many people are able to congregate and listen to Jesus, to attack Jesus in some cases, in this most boisterous and condensed and awesome week in which Jesus brings everything to fruition. Every aspect of his ministry is found in this last week. Every kind or type, from teaching, you know, straightforward information to answering questions to elevated discussions of the law to meeting the attacks of his detractors who will kill him by the end of this week. All of it is taking place here in the immediate vicinity of these 35 acres. So on page 1199, we're continuing that discussion in a transition about those that were questioning Jesus' authority. So read just the first two paragraphs there. Three times this question is going to be posed to Jesus. This attack is made on him. But if we read in the transition first, opposition to Jesus came not from the Jewish people in general, but primarily from their religious leaders and rulers, especially from the high Jewish council, which was called the Sanhedrin. To this day, this is true. The denominational teachers today are the modern-day counterparts. All these different religions that say that they are Christian religions that you see in the Yellow Pages are false and counterfeit. And in our day, making the exact same mistakes the Pharisees did of so long ago, and at war, whether they know it consciously or not, with the truth of the gospel. Continuing there, the center of this opposition was located in Jerusalem, particularly in the temple. So it was in the temple precincts that various opposing factions engaged Jesus in a series of verbal altercations, as it is to this day. It's the denominational leaders that are most at war with the truth. Now, the gospel writers record in the second paragraph a number of these controversies as occurring during Jesus' final week in Jerusalem. The challenges to Jesus appear as a series of rapid-fire encounters during a single day, see Matthew 22, but they may have taken place over a longer period of time. Well, that was the first place where we started having these supposed, questions about how things were unfolding. Certainly they took place over several days of this week. They didn't all take place on one day, and the Pharisees went home and said, we're done. It was happening on a daily basis. Everything you can imagine. Open and honest hearts to the most hardened haters of Jesus are all of them up on the Temple Mount with their own particular purposes, wanting to have a go at Jesus. So as you can see, we've been using this term three-peat. All three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, speak of this event where Jesus' authority is questioned. We're just going to look at the third one, which is actually over on page 1200. So come on, excuse me, over there. And we're going to look at Luke 20 in the right-hand column where it says Jesus silences his opponents. So Luke's account, verse 1 of chapter 20. It happened on one of those days, as he taught the people in the temple and preached the gospel, that the chief priests and scribes, together with the elders, confronted him and spoke to him, saying, "Tell us, by what authority are you doing these things? Or who is he who gave you this authority?" Every word Jesus utters is a threat to this group of men's power. So their authority is being threatened. And so they want to know, who do you think you are to be teaching like this? But he answered in verse 3 and said to them, "I also will ask you one thing and answer me. The baptism of John, was it from heaven or from men?" Brother, that was 3.5 years ago John was baptized. John was murdered by Herod. And so we've got, major problems events that have unfolded since that time. John's been dead for 3 years, but Jesus asked that question for a very pointed reason. Was it from heaven or from men? And they reasoned among themselves, saying, "If we say from heaven, he'll say, 'Why then did you not believe him?' But if we say from men, all the people will stone us, for they're persuaded that John was a prophet." So they answered they didn't know where it was from, where that baptism was from. And Jesus said to them, "Neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things." All Jesus did, of course, was expose their hypocrisy. You're demanding this answer from me. You wouldn't answer such a question yourself. But he also forces them, and you have to know, brethren, at the time, the people would see it. Because they had to scurry off and have a consultation. So, you've got, "I'll tell you the answer to your question if you'll tell me the answer to mine. Was John's baptism from heaven or men?" Now, brother, how much time is it going to take to answer that question? They've had 3 years to figure it out. What's the answer? Well, it's either yes or no. But you don't need a meeting of the Sanhedrin to figure it out. And that's what they did. So the people were standing right there, watch those guys go and do their huddle, and they have this, "Well, what are we going to do? We're caught. We don't think he's a prophet. We think it's from men. But they think he's a prophet. So we're going to play the hypocrite here and say we don't know." Well, whose job is it? And why are they there? What was their question? By what authority are you doing these things? So where were they 3 years ago when John was preaching? Should have been asking the same question. And they were. And what was their answer back then? "No, you're not. You have no authority." Okay? So Jesus is just so brilliant. Well, he's the Son of God. They're busted and exposed. They're hypocrites. And when they're caught, the heart isn't softened. It doesn't repent. It doesn't say, "Oh, I need to be honest." It just gets angrier and will culminate in the end of his life. Now, I'll take no time whatsoever for this magnificent chart on page 1201. But I just wanted to direct your attention to it. That's just the best one I've ever seen. So, I'll write these guys' cases pretty hard. I don't think they got their act together. But in this case, that's magnificent. So you got Judea and Galilee and Gaulonitis in three columns. And then you've got the dates, they're given over here in the left. And then the boxes so that you can see the information that goes with Herod the Great and his influence in each of those areas. And then you can see Archelaus and Herod Antipas and Philip, who are his sons. And then you can see the Agrippas, who are his grandsons. So it's just marvelous how it shows you all the verses that deal with each one of these people, the areas in which they had been made kings, and how they therefore are intersecting the life of Jesus, as well, of course, as that of Paul, the other apostles and Christians, as we get on down into the book of Acts all the way to the end there. You see Acts 23 and 24 being prison reference. And so that's one of those where, you know, like I do so often, I get stacks of those little, the smallest, post-it notes. And then you stick those, you know, in your Bible. And this is one of those pages where you want to have one of those post-it notes stuck. Because as we go down to the next 30 years of the church's early history, that's a chart you might want to be able to find again, because all these characters are going to be rising up on the pages of the book of Acts, and it'd be nice for you to be able then to just jump right back and find it. Now, yeah, Bill, go ahead.
Down at the bottom of the chart on the left side, where Felix and Festus are listed at, was this about AD 59 when Paul was in his final imprisonment?
No. Festus, in the one in the last line there, 59 to 62 in Acts 24, is the one that is going to be the last of these on the chart and in the book of Acts. And Paul's going to spend 2 years there, but he's going to be released. And so there'll be another 6 years that Paul will live after the end of the book of Acts. And it isn't until about 68 that he'll be murdered by Nero in Rome. So this chart is going through the family of Herod. Nero's not part of that family. And it's going through Roman governors under the kings of Herod. But, you know, it's the emperor Nero's above everything. So Nero doesn't get on there. But no, Paul's going to live until 68, we think, 68. And that would be 6 years after the end of this particular chart. Okay, so on pages 1200 to 1203, we're going to be able to save a lot of time tonight because we've got three accounts of virtually every single thing. So the reading was just being repeated over and over again. But I just want to make note here, because of last week's and the week before, these wicked vine dressers that all three of them address, and we'll look at page 1203 in just a minute, this is a parable that has many of the elements and is very similar to the parable of the minas, where the king went away to receive his kingdom and he left them, you know, working with certain amounts of money, and they judged him, and the ones that didn't want to have him as king, he's going to kill, back on page 1193. The withering of the tree is for a purpose. It's to show that if you don't bear fruit, you're going to be cut down. The parable of the two sons, you know, one repents, and it doesn't. The vine dressers in 1203 that we're about to look at, they're all extremely similar. So one of the more prominent topics on Jesus' mind in the last week, in which he's been preaching, you know, just repeatedly in many different contexts and in different manners, all has to do with this eschatological, that is, end times discussion about a judgment that is coming on these people. So, I'm sorry, let's go to 1203 then. And we have, you know, we'll just do the reading in Luke 20 at verse 9. He began to tell the people this parable. A certain man planted a vineyard, leased it to vine dressers, went into a far country for a long time. Well, it's like the one we had about the king with the parable of the minas. Now at vintage time, he sent a servant to the vine dressers that they might give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. But the vine dressers beat him and sent him away empty-handed. Then he sent another servant, beat him also, treated shamefully, sent him away empty-handed. Then he sent a third, they wounded him also and cast him out. The owner of the vineyard said, "What shall I do? I'll send my beloved son. Probably they'll respect him when they see him." But when the vine dressers saw him, they reasoned among themselves, saying, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him, that the inheritance may be ours." So they cast him out of the vineyard and killed him. Therefore, what will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He'll come and destroy those vineyards vine dressers rather, and give the vineyard to others. When they heard it, they said, certainly not. Now, brethren, that's their way of saying, may it never be. We'd hope this would never take place. Okay, but he looked at them and he said, what then is this that is written? The stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. Whoever falls on that stone will be broken, but on whomever it falls, it'll grind him to powder. And the chief priests and the scribes that very hour sought to lay hands on him because they feared the people, for they knew he had spoken this parable against them. Now we're getting parable after parable. This is the fourth that has to do with those rejectors of the king, or in this case, the vineyard owner, and who are killing his son, are themselves going to be destroyed. And the kingdom, in this case, the vineyard, given to others, which, of course, is the opening of the kingdom, the vineyard, to the Jews and the Gentiles all together. Okay, so, well, see, I guess I turn my page here. Now, we want to go to page 1204 and 1205. Actually 1203 and 4. I got the wrong number on there. But this rendering unto Caesar, we're going to do very rapidly. Everybody knows the story. It's one of the more famous. So we'll just do Matthew 22, verse 15 there at the right-hand column on 1203. Pharisees went and plotted how they might entangle him in his talk. They sent to him their disciples with the Herodians, saying, teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God in truth, nor do you care about anyone. Well, they're trying to pump him up so that he'll speak out against the Romans, they hope. Or either way, they're going to trap him. You don't regard the person of men. Tell us, therefore, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? But Jesus perceived their wickedness and said, why do you test me, you hypocrites? Show me the tax money. So they brought him a denarius. He said to them, whose image and inscription is this? They said to him, Caesar's. And he said to them, render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. When they heard, they marveled and left him and went their way. So we're all very familiar with that. We get the message. Not hard to understand it. This is very likely the actual coin that they would have brought to him. The very one. There's been a number of these that have turned up through the years. And this one was in service from 14 to 37. It depicts Tiberius, and it is an unknown female on the obverse side. But very likely, this is the very coin that is in question. Render to who what is due them? Render to him. He's got coins. He's got taxes. You'll render to him what's due to him. Okay, what's due to God hasn't got much to do, you know, with coins that got Tiberius' face on him. So his point is well taken. Now, that brings us to 1204. And again, all three of the writers tell us about the Sadducees' resurrection test. Got to give them credit for it. It's a most ingenious argument. No doubt they had discomfited the Pharisees endlessly with this argument. You know, it is a great one. You know, it's ridiculously wrong, but their ignorance, you know, has convinced them that since they could beat the ignorance of the Pharisees, that their ignorance was superior to the others' ignorance. You know, that's all it was people didn't know what they were talking about, getting together and discussing this thing, and just because one group can't answer a particular question, that does not mean that the other group is correct. It just means that they don't know the answer to the question. So we'll work with Matthew on page 1204, starting there in the right column at chapter 22 and verse 23. The same day, the Sadducees who say there is no resurrection. What else do they say there is no of? They don't believe in angels. They don't believe in an afterlife. So the resurrection is, you know, how you would get to an afterlife. And so they didn't believe in any of these three. The Pharisees believed in all three. So the Pharisees are going to take their shot. They don't believe in the resurrection. They said, teacher, Moses said if a man dies and the old Levirate law, brother has to raise up children to his childless brother's widow, you know, seven times, whose wife will she be in the resurrection? The error, of course, is assuming that then after the resurrection, everything's going to be exactly the way it is now. People are still going to be married. You know, I don't know what they would do with this question. when you had a marriage and a divorce and a remarriage, how they would answer their own question. When you had a marriage, a death, and then somebody who's been widowed, a widower, who marries, wouldn't it be the same question? They didn't have any trouble with that, of course. They're practicing those things themselves, but somehow they thought this one, you know, was going to fix the teacher here. All those questions are identical. It's the same question. What happens if marriages in the afterlife? Jesus answered and said to them at verse 29, "You're mistaken, not knowing the Scriptures nor the power of God." So their ignorance exists on two levels. "For the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels of God in heaven. But concerning the resurrection of the dead, have you not read that was spoken to you by God, saying, 'I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob'?" God's not the God of the dead, but of the living. And when the multitudes heard this, they were astonished at his teaching. So, friend or foe, everybody realizes that the great questions of the day, the finest minds, you know, your Harvard and Yale professors, you know, posing these questions, and nobody can answer them. They're so brilliant, so they must be right. Well, they're dead wrong. They're a bunch of hypocritic fools. And Jesus, just like that, you know, points it out. Why anybody who says that they trust the Bible would still go on thinking that just because somebody today has a degree from a religious school and he must, you know, somehow be infallible, beats me. Anything Jesus made plain is that the more common people, often as not, were the ones that could understand what the Scripture said, because they didn't have all the biases and hypocrisy and the need to protect their power and their influence and their great name and all of that. You know, nothing's changed at all. So you're ignorant, you don't know your Bible at all, and you're hypocrites to boot. Jesus never afraid to point it out. Now, let's go on. Page 1206 now. Remember, intervening pages are repeats of the same information. So, what's the greatest commandment? Again, this time, we have two, Matthew and Mark, to tell us about it. We'll use Mark. Again, I forgot to change the number there. The one I'm looking for is 1206. I should say 1206. So it's Mark 12, 28 through 37. "And one of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning together, perceiving he'd answer them well," event we just read, "he asked him, 'Which is the first commandment of all?' And Jesus answered him, 'The first of all the commandments is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. This is the first commandment. And the second, like it, is this: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these." Now, just a sidelight for a moment. Been a year now, you know, since we've had our debate with the Seventh-day Adventists. Brethren, what are the two greatest commandments? Well, those two right there. Are either one of them in the Ten Commandments on the stones that Moses brought down? Neither one of them. But aren't they both greater than those ten? Yes, they are. And if the Seventh-day Adventists would just spend a little bit of time thinking about it, their great argument that the ten are the great moral law and they're superior to everything else and all else can go away except those ten, and they have to come back over again, you know, and therefore we have to keep the Sabbath, it's founded on a fundamentally flawed premise. It's somehow, because these are written on stone, that they're more important, that they are more powerful than any, and more enduring than any other commandments. But Jesus tells us more than one place. The two greatest commandments aren't on those two tablets of stone, see? And so their whole theory about how to rank commandments on what's the greatest, you know, just falls flat, and everything after that that they've tried to propose to bind us to the old law and to the ten and to the Sabbath, just utterly incorrect. But this man answers well. And so, Jesus answers first, the scribe does too, but in verse 32, let's get the scribe. "So he said to him, 'Well said, teacher, you've spoken the truth. There is one God, there's no other but he, and to love him with all the heart, with all the understanding, with all the soul, and with all the strength,'" Deuteronomy 6, "'and to love one's neighbor as oneself,' Leviticus 19, is more than all the whole burnt offerings and sacrifices. Now when Jesus saw, he answered wisely. He said to him, you are not far from the kingdom of God. And after that, no one dared question him. he's defeating everybody. But the honest heart, like this man, he also answers in such a manner that everybody just struck speechless. Now, brethren, did Jesus say that that man was in the kingdom? Did Jesus say that that man would be in the kingdom? All he says is that man is what? Not far. Now, you know, my illustration, how much I love this, brother, if you're standing on a 10-story building and you jump across the alley to the other 10-story building and there's 10 feet between the two buildings and you jump 9 feet, 11 and a half inches, how dead are you? That's close. It's not far, but you're 10 stories wrong, aren't you? Okay? Only on horseshoes, you have to go the whole distance. And so, this is the point, is that this man needed more. He was close. He was getting it. And a lot of people today are like this man. I like to think he made it. I hope he made it. We just don't know. But until he goes the rest of the distance, he's not going to be in the kingdom. He is outside the kingdom. Your job and mine, brethren, and it is nothing clearer, is to help people go the last few inches. We live in a culture that is rapidly abandoning all the Bible. Your children and grandchildren, brethren, I'm telling you, you watch Gender Revolution and the rest of this, you know, we're gonna see amazing times ahead because it is just a complete abandonment of all biblical morality and thought processes that we're witnessing in our time. It's truly frightening. Okay? But still, we have a majority, though barely, in America that at least nominally believes in the Bible. But they're stopping short. Instead of becoming a part of the one church that Jesus said he would build and the gates of Hades could never prevail against it, they're joining and, you know, they're committed to groups that didn't exist for hundreds of years after the church Jesus built. Doesn't resemble the church Jesus built. And even those who get fairly close are still not it. Our job is to help them go the rest of the way. So with that, let's leave that back. Excuse me again. We come to the last section of this week's reading, which begins at Matthew 23 on page 1206 in the lower right-hand column. And everything to the end of our reading today, essentially, which goes all the way up to page 1215, is revolving around Matthew 23 and 24 and 25 and their parallels in Mark 13 and Luke 21. Now, in each case, Jesus said a lot there on the Mount of Olives as he looked down there at that Temple Mount from the height above it on the Mount of Olives. He said an awful lot about a coming judgment. And so, all that material, all those pages, but they're all saying the same thing, where Jesus now, a couple of days before he dies, takes a tremendous amount of time. The lengthiest thing he's going to say in this week is this, Matthew, starting there in 23 and 24 and 25. Now, as you know, a lot of material, as you know, very condensed material. Many expressions that you really need to go back to your Old Testament and look through pages and pages and pages, you know, work all of this out. So all we're going to do is just the barest of highlights tonight. We did it in the introduction to Revelation. We've done it, you know, here not long ago, leading up here and working with the harmonies and in other contexts. So, what's going on? Well, look over on page 1207. On page 1207, and I just used a little numeral and then a circle around it in the center column, right on the line, and then over on the right, to reference now these eight woe unto yous. So the first one is that first full paragraph in the left column on 1207. Woe to you, verse 13, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. You shut up the kingdom of heaven against men. You neither go in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. Tremendous numbers of people in America today that are exactly that. They call them pastors. They call them bishops. They call them priests. Call them any number of things. But they shut up the kingdom because what they teach is the opposite of what the scriptures teach in answer to the question, what must I do to be saved? They deceive, they mislead, and it doesn't matter if they're ignorant and don't know what they're doing, or honest-hearted but just misled and fooled themselves, or as deceitful, you know, as so many of these preachers keep getting busted, it seems like, nearly on a weekly basis, you know, in all their corruption. They're the same thing Jesus had in the first century. So woe unto you. You're not entering the kingdom yourself. You're not allowing other people to enter in. And then, in the rest of that paragraph is number 2, woe to you scribes and Pharisees. The next paragraph starts off verse 15 with number 3, woe to you scribes and Pharisees. The next paragraph, verse 16, woe to you blind guides. He uses a different expression. The bottom paragraph, 23, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, is number 5. Then over there in the right-hand column, number 6, starts at verse 25, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. The 7th is verse 27, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. 29 is woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, and that's number 8. So you've got 8 woes unto you. In addition to this, back in the middle of a paragraph at verse 19, he added fools and blind. And then, the top right, the next to the last line there at verse 24, he called them blind guides. And in the middle of the paragraph 25 at verse 26, he says blind Pharisees. And at the bottom, starting in verse 31, but actually in verse 33, he calls them serpents and brood of vipers. How diplomatic was this exchange? Jesus kind of got a beef with some people, and he telling them about it. Now, brethren, suppose you're listening to that sermon. You're standing there. How many of you would think, boy, I'll tell you what, it's going to be tough 2,000 years from now when the end of the world comes, because those guys are sure going to be a bunch of hypocrites. It's not 2,000 years in the future he's talking about. What's he talking about? He's been talking about for the last 4 parables that all had to do with these hypocritical religious leaders of his time. That builds, turn the page on 1208, to verse 37, first full paragraph in the left-hand column. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. For I say to you, you shall see me no more till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. What city is he talking about? Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. And that house is going to be left desolate. Now, already at the introduction, mentioned the transition on the right side of 1208. It's here where they try to convince you that there are two focuses and the chapter is going to jump ship right in the middle and suddenly start talking about the end of the world. But at least they recognize in the second paragraph of that transition that the discourse warns of approaching tribulation and the first focus is the near future and the destruction of Jerusalem by the Roman army. Beyond all doubt, that's true. These uninspired commentators' only problem is that they don't stand on that truth, and then they decide to introduce ideas about some mythical second focus that just doesn't exist. Now, the bottom of that column in Matthew 24, 1 through 3. Jesus went out, departed from the temple, his disciples came up to show him what? Real loud, tell me. What did they show him? The buildings of the temple. Jesus said to them, do you not what? See. What? All these things. Surely I say to you, not one what? Stone shall be left where? Here upon another that shall not be what? Thrown down. Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And we spend a lot of time on this, brethren. How many questions are there? 2. Turn the page to 12:10. Let none of the religious hypocrites of today tell you there are three questions. There's only two interrogatives there. And neither Mark nor Luke knew about any mythical, legendary, amorphous, and impossible third question about the end of the world. They're pointing at stones piled on top of each other. 13:1, he went out of the temple. One of his disciples said, "Teacher, see what manner of stones, what buildings are here." And Jesus answered, said, "Don't you see these great buildings? Not one stone here will be left upon another, not be thrown down." As he sat on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter, James, John, and Andrew asked him privately three questions. "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign when all these things will be fulfilled?" You see a third question anywhere in there? No, there's only two, not three. Turn over next page, 12:11, and Luke chapter 21. Look down the bottom of the left-hand column at verse 7. They asked him, saying, "Teacher, when will these things be, and what sign will there be when these things are about to take place?" How many questions? Two. They all have to do, both of them, with what? The temple we're pointing at and the stones that are stacked up to create it. Now, coming back to Matthew, in chapter 24, on page 1, 1208, and spilling on to 1209, the answer, well, actually, the answer is all of it in 1209, starting in verse 4. Verses 4 through 13, Jesus tells them what the sign will not be. Don't get excited about any of this stuff. Don't you worry about the wars and the pestilences and earthquakes. That's just the beginning. But look at verse 14 at the end of that second paragraph. "This gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come." What end? The end of the age they asked about. The end of the temple age, the end of the Jewish age, the end of the Mosaic age, which needed a temple standing to function. The end of that will come when the gospel is preached in all the world. If you've been in any of my other classes, you'll know that twice in Colossians 1, also in Romans 10, verse 28, Paul will declare that by 62 A.D., the gospel had been preached in all the world. Paul said so. What must then come? The end that they asked about. But this isn't believed by denominational people today. No, they asked about the end of the world, too, and that hasn't happened yet. The big problem there, then, brethren, is verse 15 that follows. "When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." This is an escapable judgment on a physical city that these people want to avoid. And he tells them, the end will come when the gospel is preached, and Paul tells us it happens in that generation. And then, when you see the abomination, and when they see, the people he's talking to, see the abomination of desolation in the holy place, flee to the mountains, escape the judgment. Now, if you'll come over to Luke chapter 21, we can wrap all this up at verse 20 in the right-hand column of 12:11, where about a little ways past the half, it says, "Destruction of Jerusalem. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea do what? Flee to the mountains." What is the abomination of desolation? Armies encircling Jerusalem. The Roman armies would do that some 37 years later. We end with the very top of 12:10. In the left-hand column at the top, verse 34. "Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away until a few of these things take place." But I've got two focuses, and the rest of the stuff will happen 2,000 years later. Does Jesus say anything like that? What did he say about all the things that they asked about and all the things that he said? It would take place when? That generation. That's the one thing he's talking about in these chapters that Jesus at such great length is discussing. Here's the chart you've seen before. I'll leave it with you tonight. You just heard the bell. Those things that people think have to talk about the end of the world, but which occur in the passage three verses before the statement that all these things will take place in this generation. The darkened sun, the darkened moon, the falling stars, the shaken heavens, the coming on the clouds, all of those are expressions that you find in Isaiah and Joel and Ezekiel and Daniel and Jeremiah. The Jew knew what they were hearing. They were hearing that that city and that temple would be dismantled by Roman armies in their generation because the stones they were looking at were going to come to an end. That covenant would be no more. And why? Because about 5 days from now, the Son of the Living God will rise from the dead. And you'll have one generation's time to believe it if you're a Jew in the first century. And then the old covenant will be annihilated in every conceivable way. 70 AD, September, the Romans dismantled the temple. Class dismissed.